Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 9th of March 1924, Churchill shows his support for the Conservatives by standing against them. But first, an omission admission. Last week I covered the Hitler-Ludendorff trial. I made reference to testimony from Erich von Ludendorff, one Colonel Kriebel, and a former Munich chief of police. But there was someone I missed. Hitler. Now, in my defence, Hitler only gets a mention right at the bottom of an article entitled Munich Treason Trial, with the subtitle The Charge Against Ludendorff, and the further subtitle Hitler's Defence. Okay, that's not much of a defence. Anyway, this is what it says. Beginning almost nervously, the little Austrian sign painter soon recovered himself, and his speech was reminiscent of many that he had made in the beer halls of Munich. Little Austrian sign painter, eh? Well, he was Austrian, but I'm pretty sure he was never a sign painter. He was an artist. He was a painting painter. And little? Oh, I don't know. I know there's an ongoing debate about that. There was no applause, but it was evident that the sympathies of a very large proportion of those who were in the court were with the speaker, when, with emphatic gesture, he declared that it was not himself or his associates who were on trial, but His Excellency Herr von Kahr, the dictator, and that but for the dictator's treachery, a national government which could have saved Germany would now have been in power. Once more, the details of the scheme at the Bürgerbräu Keller were gone into at great length. After he had spoken for nearly 4 hours, the court was adjourned. 4 hours, and that is all, O Times correspondent, you have to say. I know Adolf can be a bit turgid, but even so, I think there would be more to report on. Well, if the Times' correspondent had missed something, Wilhelm Marx, Chancellor of Germany, has not. This is from Tuesday the 4th. Many of the younger Catholics seem to think that Germany will be reborn by way of a nationalist movement for the restoration of German hegemony. If this idea gained ground, the consequences would be worse than a war. He had been shocked on reading in Hitler's evidence the statement, "We must have people with fanatic hatred." And now some of the other stories that have caught my attention this week. The Turkish Parliament has abolished the Caliphate, and the Caliph has been expelled. I would say more if I understood the significance, but I don't. Winston Churchill is standing in a by-election in the Abbey Division in Westminster. More on that later. On Monday, the Times reported on a document that purported to be the Turkish Army's assessment of the Gallipoli campaign. It is difficult to tell for sure, but the numbers given for casualties were very close to modern estimates, so there is a good chance the report was genuine. The main takeaway, and a surprise to me, was that the Turks thought the Allies could have won if they had tried a bit harder. Another surprise to me was the total Allied casualties, which were about 300,000. That's more than Passchendaele. I saw this in Tuesday's episode. According to the Neue Berliner Zeitung, the Minister of Labour, Dr. Browns, speaking at a gathering of the German Catholic Association held in the Reichstag yesterday, said that the present number of unemployed in Germany was 5 million. He is further reported as having said that no fewer than 15 million persons altogether were receiving public relief in some form or other. This would mean that a quarter of the population was either unemployed or underemployed. No official figures so far issued have shown anything approaching this number. That's not far off the 6 million it hit during the Great Depression, and was such a boost for the Nazis. I say that, but this morning I was listening to Frank McDonough on the History Rage podcast. He pointed out that the Nazis got very little support from industrial areas, i.e. those areas which, I would guess, were worst hit by the Great Depression. I think I can help Professor McDonough out here. The unemployment proved a boost for communism, and the threat of communism proved a boost for Nazism. A couple of weeks ago, in the 24th of February episode, I covered the annual general meeting of the United Electric Railways of London. That is a company that owns several other companies. What I didn't realise, and is something I'm quite sure would not happen today, is each subsidiary gets its own AGM and its own write-up in the Times. In his speech to the London and Suburban Traction Company, the chairman, Lord Ashfield again, said that trams were losing out to buses, partly because buses were getting bigger. From our point of view, this sounds like a bad thing. Trams are smooth and quiet. Buses are noisy and smelly. And intuitively, we tend to think the fumes can't be good for us. But our ancestors may have seen things differently. Trams of the day weren't that quiet. Buses were petrol-driven, so may have been quieter and less fumy than their modern-day equivalents. But the real point is in those days, London would have been full of smoke from the burning of coal. A few or even a lot of petrol-driven buses would not have made a great deal of difference. They may even have acted as an air freshener. A ditto tobacco. Buses do have their downsides, though. On Monday the 3rd, the Times reported that, in Newcastle, a bus crashed into a tram pole and caught fire. Two passengers burnt to death. In 1922, the tens, if not hundreds, of railways in Britain were forced to merge into four companies. Grouping, as it was known. The amalgamation of three railways in South London, which became known as Southern Railway, this week held its first annual general meeting. During his speech, the chairman had this to say. On the southwestern section, the number of passengers carried in the electrified area has increased from 23 million in 1915 to 49 million in 1923. Railway men like to talk about the sparks effect. When a railway is electrified, as this one was in 1915, or actually 1916 to be exact, passengers increase. And here it is, clear as day. But why would it be? Is it modernity? Well, we all like modern things, but if it isn't that much more useful, it's only going to be a temporary fillip to ridership one. Well, I assume so anyway. Is it cleanliness? Well, certainly electric trains are cleaner. You know, you don't have a locomotive at the front billowing smoke. But as I was saying earlier, London is full of smoke. So you wouldn't have thought that would make much difference, not at that time anyway. Could it be speed? I believe electric trains tend to be a bit quicker, but only a bit quicker. Could it be frequency? I would guess it would be easier to run a more intensive service with electric trains because they're easier to turn around at stations. No locomotive involved. So that's a possibility. Could it be cost? Although the capital, obviously the capital expenditures are enormous in electrifying a line, the operational costs, because you'd no longer need a fireman on the locomotive, would be less. As it happens, when the Southern Railway's predecessor was preparing to electrify the line originally in 1916, the plan had been to reduce the fares, but war intervened. So I'm not quite sure what happened then. There is, of course, I mean, talking about the war, of course, this line was originally electrified during the war. Could that have had something to do with it? Could that have depressed the ridership in 1915? Possibly, but it's not for sure because in 1915, Britain was far from being on a, well, I wouldn't say war footing, but it had not gone over to total war at that stage. So, I don't know. Not everything is going well on the railways. This is from Friday the 7th. An attempt to wreck a train, fortunately unsuccessful, was discovered at Egham last night. The driver of the 5:48 train from Waterloo to Reading reported on arrival at Egham that he felt a bump when his engine passed the Egham Causeway crossing. A porter was sent to investigate. and he found that an iron chair used to fix the metals to the sleepers had been placed on the line and was held in position by stones carefully packed upon either side of the rail. Fortunately, the chair had been placed in a straight position, with the result that the engine crashed clean through it, cutting it in half, without derailing either the engine or coaches. The train was filled with business people going home from London, and the spot where the attempt was made is surrounded by houses. So far, there is no clue as to the identity of the person or persons concerned. Well, maybe I can help the police with their inquiries. The crossing in question, if it's the one I think it is bang next to the Lagonda car factory. Also, this story serves as one of those occasional reminders to myself that there is nothing new about vandalism. Murderous intent is not exclusive to Egham. This is from Tuesday the 4th. A storm of protest has been aroused in New York by the announcement that Eugene O'Neill's play, All God's Chillen Got Wings, is soon to be produced here by the Provincetown Players with a mixed cast of white and Negro actors. Negro is just what they said in those days. The police, who were asked to prevent the performance on the ground that it is likely to lead to race riots, have declared themselves powerless to intervene except in the face of actual violence. Hundreds of letters voicing indignation against the proposed production have already been received by the theatre management, and the newspapers thought the first performance would not take place for several weeks. Mr. O'Neill has remained unmoved by all protests. He said yesterday that the racial element in the play is incidental, and added that Robeson, that's Paul Robeson, the leading man, was an excellent actor who had played opposite a well-known white actress in England. Bear in mind, this is not the Deep South. This is New York, the biggest, richest city in the United States, a city that is not a great recruiting ground for the Ku Klux Klan. How things have changed. When I see people doing something that would appall modern sensibilities, I do try to find some sort of rationality behind it, but I'm struggling to do so. Also, do I detect a slightly snobbish European attitude to their American cousins? The way they treat black people. We, who don't have any to speak of, are so much better. Some perils are rather more real. This is a letter published on the 3rd of March from a Mr. M.W. Fox Strangways, Acting Secretary, Charity Organisation Society. May I ask for your good offices in warning secretaries and officials of charities against a woman who has for some time been preying on some of them by a specially adapted form of the confidence trick, stating that her mother, or brother, has left a large sum of money for distribution to charities, she arranges to pay a visit of inspection, and holds out hope of a generous donation. Then, at the moment of departure, she discovers that she has lost her purse, or it may be her return ticket, or both. The secretary, gratified by the promise of a new hospital ward perhaps, or a chapel, as the case may be, for the lady is magnificent in her undertakings, naturally proffers a loan of anything up to £5, with which the Lady Bountiful disappears. Talking of things disappearing, in those days real teeth were thin on the ground, and I think I know why. This is from Tuesday the 4th, and is from an Edith Picton Turverville. On every pound of sugar, an essential food energy, the purchaser contributes nearly twice the value of the sugar towards the national exchequer. Even a small family cannot manage on less than £3 a week if the children are to have even a moderate amount of necessary nourishment. £3? They couldn't have put it all in tea. Cakes? Were we a nation of jam makers? But even so, when I was a child, there were no end of jokes about false teeth, because lots of people had them. No wonder. Last week I mentioned that Winston Churchill, the Liberal, as he was at the time, was saying nice things about the Conservative/Unionist Party. there is a by-election imminent in the Abbey Division of London. That is very central. It includes the Houses of Parliament. Churchill attempted to gain the Conservative nomination, but was turned down. So he has decided to stand as an independent. So, Churchill being Churchill, he has decided to stand as an independent. This is from Monday the 3rd. I wish to work effectually with the Conservative Party in resistance to the rapid advance of socialism and in opposition to the Socialist Party and its allies, whoever they may be. The present so-called three-party system is unhealthy, unnatural, and absurd. Talking of the threat of socialism, he said this. I should be willing as an independent and constitutional candidate to expose this great issue and imminent struggle to the electors of the Westminster Abbey Division. This is from Thursday. My candidature is in no way hostile to the Conservative Party or its leaders. On the contrary, I recognise that that party must now become the main rallying ground for the opponents of the Socialist Party. The irony is not lost on the Times' correspondent. This is from Wednesday. But his avowed anxiety to work with the Conservative Party, without actually declaring himself a Conservative, has now taken a curious form. His first act of cooperation proves to be an attempt to keep out of the House of Commons the official Conservative candidate. But Churchill is not alone. This is from Thursday. A good deal of resentment is felt at the fact that some Unionist members have announced their intention of appearing on a platform in opposition to the Unionist candidate. Churchill has name recognition. The Times thinks it understands his motivations. This is from Tuesday the 4th. His experiences between 1914 and 1922, when he was a member of the government, must have made it plain to him that both for support of the policies which he most cared about and for opposition to the policies which he most distrusted, it was rather to the Conservatives than to the Liberals that he must look. From that discovery, the natural conclusion must have been that he should return to the party in which he began his political life. Yes, Churchill started off as a Conservative. He probably also has serious doubts today whether that party, they mean the Liberal Party, has any future. Certainly no party has ever lost ground more rapidly than the Liberals in the last month. This is probably a reference to the way the Liberal Party is kinda sorta propping up the minority Labour government. Others writing in the Times are less willing to give Churchill the benefit of the doubt. This is from Thursday. Mr. Churchill, in fact, not for the first time in his career, has mistimed an important decision and shown himself an essentially disruptive force. He had in any case destroyed his line of retreat to the Liberals, whose immediate response to his independent candidature is to put forward a candidate of their own. But despite this, the correspondent has to admit Churchill's got a point. The grave conflict with socialism, which Mr. Churchill avows his intention of undertaking, is assuredly no chimerical or unnecessary crusade. No one can afford to ignore the risk involved in the advent of a socialist government, dominated by all the extremists in the Labour ranks and possessed of an effective working majority. No ordinary politician could get away with this. Certainly not today, and as far as I am aware, not then either. But Churchill had an ability to attract attention, even then. Anyway, that's all for this week. At this point, I believe I'm supposed to say something about liking and subscribing, if you're logged in, that is. In the meantime, I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.